Okay, and coming up next, we've got Subversity with Dan Tseng. What on earth is on the show today, Dan? Any ideas? You just going to wing it?
No, not wing it. We're going to talk to a reporter and a journalism, who, a former reporter who's now a journalism professor, about the life of the publisher of Nói Việt, who's the largest Vietnamese language newspaper outside of Vietnam.
And is that newspaper located here in SoCal?
Yeah, Little Saigon.
Oh, Little Saigon. That's up in L.A., right?
That's in Westminster, Orange County.
Okay, got it. Cool. All right, so I think I've seen that off the freeway, like off the 5 or the 405 or something, Little Saigon. So, yeah, that's very cool. The largest Vietnamese, you said, newspaper here in SoCal. And Dan Tseng is going to be talking with them, so stay tuned. That's pretty cool guest lined up there. Don't go anywhere. This has been the Serena Sharp Show. I'll talk to you. Actually, I will not be here next Monday morning. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks, Monday morning.
Today, we're going to be talking with a former reporter and journalism communications professor at Cal State Fullerton about the life of Yen Do, who's the publisher, who was the publisher of Nói Việt, the largest Vietnamese language newspaper outside of Vietnam, who passed away last Thursday. Welcome, Yen. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Dan.
Yeah, Jeff Brody is the a friend of Yen Do, and also covered him since the 80s when he wrote for the OC Register, Orange County Register. What are your biggest impressions of Yen Do?
Well, Yen was clearly the community's leading intellectual. There's just something exceptional about him. He had a photographic memory and just a passion for covering community events, learning about world history, and giving, you know, the immigrant community news about Vietnam. He is one of the most impressionable people I've ever met in my life. I was always impressed by his intellect, his knowledge, the scope of his learning. And he was basically a self-taught man. But he had that, you know, curiosity, that twinkle in his eye to always want to learn more.
You're listening to Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is Dan Tseng, the host. We're talking with Jeff Brody, who penned an obituary of Yen Do in the Orange County Register last Friday. Do you think he was a bridge between the community and the outside community?
Yeah, that clearly is one of the functions of the ethnic press. I mean, not just the Vietnamese language press, but when we had a strong, you know, and vibrant Italian-American press or Polish-American press, that the ethnic editor sees himself as a bridge between the mainstream community and the ethnic community. In many ways, Yen Do did this. He would print articles on how to get a driver's license, how to apply for Social Security, how to pay taxes, informational articles that allowed refugees to adjust to American life. He also explained, you know, how to, in his newspaper early on, you know, how to register to vote, mm-hmm. how to become a citizen.
He also played a leading role in one of the earlier controversies in the community about the about TB, tuberculosis.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the ethnic editors also become, in effect, community activists and practice what we know as community journalism, and that they become advocates for the community. And in the early 80s, there was a controversy over the tuberculosis test for Vietnamese children that was administered in the school system because nearly all of them were reporting positive. And it created a big scare in Orange County. And the reason was that the Vietnamese were administered a different type of vaccine than Americans normally get. The Vietnamese were getting a live vaccine. It was developed by the French, which would immunize them against tuberculosis, but unfortunately registered positive on the American time test. So it created a big scare in the community, and what Yen had to do was organize a group of professors, medical professors from the University of California, Irvine, and the Vietnamese community itself, and they held press conferences, and Yen served as a liaison with the mainstream press, you know, explaining the issue to sort of quell the hysteria that had arisen in Orange County.
Because people were afraid to go to Vietnamese owned shops.
There was a big scare that they said, you know, all the refugees are, you know, carriers of this dreaded disease, tuberculosis.
So he didn't see a conflict between being an advocate and being an editor or at that time of the publication then?
Yeah, not at all. It's sort of like different from some of the mainstream papers which want to be objective and not involved in politics. The editors of the ethnic press generally, you know, play a different type of role because their communities are minority communities, and they often have to explain things to the outlying community and advocate, especially when there's prejudice or racism, to, you know, resolve, you know, some of these issues and educate people so that they will not be, you know, prejudiced. Some of this prejudice arises out of, you know, ignorance that they don't know. And in this case with the tuberculosis, it was ignorance. They were unaware of the French-type vaccine.
For sure. So this was advocacy journalism. But the community is quite fractured, I suppose, politically. And how did he navigate this kind of line between being a voice for the community, but also not letting the kind of more extreme elements take over?
Well, you see, you bring up a really good point, Dan. We have the role of the editor in politics regarding the outlying community. Then we have the role of the editor in politics involving the in-group, the Vietnamese community. And the in-group politics, Vietnamese politics within, you know, Orange County's Little Saigon, are fractured and divided, and there's a lot of jealousy and backstabbing, and can be, you know, quite vicious.
I think Tony Lam had an analogy with crabs, I guess.
Yeah, he uses the famous story that there's an American fisherman and a Vietnamese fisherman out at the Newport Pier, and the American fisherman is, you know, catching crabs along with the Vietnamese, and the American puts the crab in a basket and covers it with a lid, and the Vietnamese just throws the crabs into the basket unlidded. And finally, out of exasperation, the American says, you know, how come you don't have a lid on your basket? And he says, the Vietnamese man says to him, you don't understand, my crabs are Vietnamese. As soon as one nears the top, the others pull them down.
So that may suggest why there isn't a kind of agreed-upon leader of the community for many years.
Sure. That's, you know, that's a very clear reason that the community is plagued by infighting and an inability to unify. And that has hurt the community within community politics. But we may add that, you know, as far as electoral politics go, the community has suddenly emerged, you know, quite well with elected council people in Garden Grove, Westminster, and also in the state assembly. So you see that, you know, the politics with the mainstream American politics, the Vietnamese, I think, are integrating very well. It's always been within the community politics of Little Saigon that you have such infighting.
Well, in the interview you did, the set of interviews you did with him that emerged out, that ended up in a book, that you put out, he talks about the effects of the kind of the overwhelming effect of the Cold War on their thinking, on how, you know, they treat each other basically, and how he also distrusted the police, I suppose, because of experiences back in Vietnam, and also they didn't really have freedom of press there.
Oh, those are 3 points. First, with the Cold War, up until the end of the Cold War had a profound effect on the Vietnamese community. So up until then, the community was anti-communist and didn't want to have anything to do with the communist regime in Vietnam, and the community supported a boycott of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But at the ending of the Cold War, many thinkers, one of them, ironically, was former General Win Kao Ki, who had actually was the premier of the government,
mm-hmm.
said that maybe the best way to undermine the communist regime is to do trade and business with the communist regime and to establish relations with the communist regime so that when the people in the regime and also the people who are living under the regime see how strong, you know, the free market economy is and how well the Vietnamese have done under a free market economy, it would help undermine the regime. And one of the leaders in this respect was Co Pham, Dr. Co Pham, who was the head of the Vietnamese Chamber of Commerce. Yen had to, you know, navigate a route between reporting about the activities of the people who were reform-oriented because of, you know, the heavy pressure from some of the right-wing anti-communist elements who were diehard, who would, you know, take extreme measures, even, you know, resort to terrorism to stop any business dealings with Vietnam.
Yeah, his business was next to, Yen's business was next to a shop that sent packages to Vietnam during the, or maybe it was right after the embargo.
Yeah, and that business was firebombed. And Yen also had an incident.
Right.
Where some of the lunatic fringe in the community firebombed one of his trucks. And it was just basically because he had made a simple mistake in a TV station that was affiliated with Noi Viet, and they had broadcast film footage, stock B footage of Vietnam, and in the background there was the communist flag of Vietnam, the flag of the country right now. The refugee community only recognizes the flag of the defeated Republic of South Vietnam, which no longer exists, but...
Right.
Any affiliation with, you know, the late communist leader Ho Chi Minh or the flag is bound to draw protest.
And ironically, Schwarzenegger just a few weeks ago signed an executive order, I guess, allowing the display of the defunct South Vietnamese flag at state functions.
Yeah, that's to, show support for the refugee community here. And the flag issue is very sensitive, and it has even haunted Yendo after his death. I have to say, you know, one of the biggest shocks was there was an obituary for Yendo on CBS2.com, which is the local CBS affiliate for Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
And they printed his obituary, and next to it they put the flag of the government of Vietnam, the communist flag, the red flag with a gold star. And when the family saw it, when I saw it, we quickly, you know, called up CBS2.com and said, you know, that's something that's very inappropriate, and you got to remove the flag. And the editors there graciously did. They explained that it was just a simple mistake that, you know, they were going for clip art.
Right.
And, you know, that flag is the legitimate flag of the country, so they just, you know, needed some art, so they just put it up. And this mistake had actually happened, you know, to Tony Lam, a former councilman, when he owned a restaurant, and he put an ad in the Register, and they again went to clip art because they were having, like, ethnic restaurants. And what they do is put, like, for the Mexican restaurants, they had the Mexican flag, and the Italian restaurants, they had the Italian flag. And then for the Vietnamese restaurant, they put the Vietnamese flag, but it wasn't the South Vietnamese flag. It was the official flag. And then, you know, people were red-baiting Tony Lam as a communist, like they red-baited Yen Do as a communist. And, you know, this, when you do something like this, it can result in death or, you know, destruction to your property.
Yeah, it actually lasted for many more years after the restaurant review came out, the ad came out, because I was at high-tech... After the high-tech incident, the protesters moved to Tony Lam's restaurant and did all sorts of stuff outside the restaurant, including passing out Xeroxes or photocopies of the ad with the flag circled, and then they said it was a communist restaurant or serving Hanoi food. So,
yeah.
So that kind of legacy can trail you for years after. So that is kind of ironic.
It's almost like McCarthyism.
Yeah, you had mentioned in your longer obituary that didn't get fully into the Register, that there were incidents where many journalists were threatened and even killed.
Yeah, about five Vietnamese journalists have been killed you know, from a period of the early 80s to the early 90s. And most of them were killed for either printing ads for companies that did business with Vietnam or advocating relations with Vietnam. And they were murdered by a right-wing anti-communist group that claimed credit for it. No one has ever been caught, so it's very hard to say exactly who did the murders, although there was communiques issued from this right-wing anti-communist group.
National United Front for the Liberation of Vietnam.
No, actually, it's actually the Committee to Exterminate Communists the Nation.
Right. The other one.
That was the group that, you know, claimed credit for these murders. And, you know, Yen Do had his life threatened, you know, many times over the course of the years.
How did he print, did he cover these stories? Or, you know, when there were these kind of attacks on other journalists, did his paper cover it? Or did he just use mainstream media coverage and translated it and put it in his paper?
I think he did a little bit of both. Mm. But oftentimes when the story was very, very hot to cover and, you know, considered dangerous, we sort of had an arrangement. It was like grown out of also of the South Vietnamese experience during the war.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me give you some background. During the war, the South Vietnamese journalists faced heavy censorship.
Sure.
So oftentimes papers were printed with, you know, gaps in them, you know, just blank spaces where the stories were censored. So one of the ways that they could get a story out was if they leaked it to the foreign press, and it was printed in the foreign press, then they could, you know, republish what the foreign press had printed.
They would just cite the foreign press.
So what we did was he would often give me a tip, and I would write it and print it in the Register.
Mm-hmm.
Then he could print it in Neu Viet and attribute it to me. So you'd see in the Neu Viet, I'd see Brody said, or according to the Register, Bow Register, Brody. I'd see my name next to all this Vietnamese writing.
Uh-huh.
And that was an insurance policy. And
right.
It was clearly something that he had to do in articles that were sensitive that he knew would, you know, anger certain elements of the community. So he could say that he's not writing it, he's attributing it to me and the mainstream press.
That's very clever.
And I can say that, you know, also that, you know, it wasn't very heroic of me because I was never threatened. There's a double standard.
Mm-hmm.
There's an absolute double standard that the right-wing anti-communist elements never attacked any mainstream journalist in the United States. They only went after members of their own ethnic community. Only Vietnamese editors were endangered for printing these kinds of stories. None of the mainstream reporters like myself were ever threatened.
I'm not mainstream, but I got death threats. And after,
oh, you did?
Yeah, definitely. After I wrote about the kids that were had mug files by the police for wearing baggy pants, mm-hmm. I got a letter threatening that I should be shot. And the police at UCI said, "Well, that's not a direct threat because it said you should be shot." It's like Shakespeare writing that lawyers should be killed. And should, because of the should, they didn't think it was a real threat. But then that was on a phone call, and then I got a letter also from mm-hmm. some guy called Nathan Hall. And they tracked it down to his P.O. box. They actually sent him a letter asking for an interview. Well, of course, he didn't respond. But the mm-hmm. mailbox was registered to a number of Vietnamese names, and then Nathan Hall at the end. So I actually canceled a bunch of meetings with the Vietnamese American Coalition on campus and stuff. And then during the Hi-Tech incident, they did actually name a group named in the paper, a bunch of people, including myself, Nick Scow from OC Weekly,
mm-hmm.
and Lely Hayslip, I think as people to target. Although it wasn't clear what they were targeting about. I mean, how they would target it.
So they were going after you because they didn't like what you were printing.
Right, because I was trying to uncover some of the corruption in the community, mm-hmm. even with some social service agencies and also other stuff about Hi-Tech. During the protests, I interviewed a guy who was head of a U.S.-Vietnam relations group.
Mm-hmm.
earlier, and he was running around the courthouse waving the Vietnam flag and almost got attacked himself.
Oh.
Yeah, so it was he was a guy from San Diego, and Then I also had Talmo, the lawyer for the high-tech guy, and also the high-tech guy, the store owner who owned this store called High Tech that had put out a picture of a poster of Ho Chi Minh on my show before. So, but I think because I'm not Vietnamese, I felt a little bit easier in doing that.
Yeah, that's been the pattern that most of the attacks have been against Vietnamese, all the attacks.
Well, except that Cooperman, you know, there's a colleague of from the same school you are at now, but Edward Cooperman was head of the U.S. Vietnam Scientific Exchange Committee, and he was murdered by his student, and a lot of people believe that was a politically motivated murder.
Mm-hmm.
Although the student actually was represented by Rollo May, who was a speechwriter for Nixon, I believe. And he was a right-wing kind of person, and he represented this student, and the student only got a couple of years or 3 years for involuntary manslaughter, I believe.
You know what happened to that student?
I think his name is kind of common, and so I tried to track him down. I didn't. I wasn't successful. I've been trying to track him down. I did talk to his Cooperman's wife during the high-tech incident.
Mm-hmm.
She was still living in Orange County then. She's Dutch, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was quite a big thing, of course. I know that your school has some commemoration plaque or something.
Yes.
Yes, is that in...
He's a physics professor.
Yeah, and so anyway, he was actually bringing old equipment to Vietnam to help the economy before, you know, during the years after the war, and bringing books. I know he came to UCI and picked up books before my time. So that was a change, actually, because probably people didn't think he would get killed because he's a Westerner, but he actually was killed. So that was kind of scary. Yeah. So I know the right-wing politics in the community must have... scared him too, scared Yen Do, because he was a student activist against against the government of Nguyen Cang, right?
Yeah.
In Vietnam, and Nguyen Cang is associated, I believe, with the Free Government of Vietnam, which recently has been in the news.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people, one of the leaders, was not extradited for trial in Vietnam, but released in South Korea and came back to Garden Grove, where he lives. But I believe that the other individual that Yen Do fought against, or when he was a student in South Vietnam, demonstrated against, is now active in that group.
Yeah, the resurrection of Nguyen Cang. It's interesting because he only held power for a short time in 1964.
A few weeks.
Yen was, of course, a student activist. And the students, Vietnam at the time was enthralled in protests.
There was
Buddhists were
setting fire to themselves.
Angered, and they wanted the regime, you know, change, and they were active. They were able to accomplish that.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of history is kind of hidden because everybody thinks that every Vietnamese is anti-communist, and that history of student resistance in South Vietnam is glossed over. Nobody mentions it.
Well, Yen was part of a group of intellectuals in Vietnam who were anti-communist,
right,
but were also not so enamored with the military dictatorships that were running, you know, under U.S. sponsorship Vietnam. So they're anti-democratic, I mean anti-communist, and pro-democracy, anti-dictatorship. So they sort of represented like a third force of Vietnamese nationalists who wanted a government in South Vietnam that would be nationalistic and democratic rather than a government that would be, you know, anti-communist and dictatorship.
I've actually interviewed an activist from that period who actually was sent by the Thieu government sent by the South Vietnamese government at the time for studies in the U.S., and he went to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
But when he landed in Boston Airport, he spoke out against the war. And so he became part of this group with Chomsky and other people that were anti-war activists. So they were actually Vietnamese who were trying to look for a way out and not, you know, and basically look for a third way. Yeah. And the VSA, I believe, the Vietnamese Student Association in the 60s, did take a position against the war, and they even published a newsletter that came out of Fullerton, actually, that was anti-imperialist, actually. And so that all that history is, of course, hidden, because the majority voice, people think of the community as solid with one political perspective, whereas there's a lot of diversity. And how did Yen deal with this kind of intimidation?
Well, I got to say that Yen was anti-communist. He was influenced
definitely
by some people who had been imprisoned by the communists in Vietnam in the early 60s. He was anti-colonialist. He didn't want a French-ruled regime, and he was pro-democracy. He wanted a democratic regime. So he was a person who was against the communists, and he was against the dictators who were running his country, and he wanted, you know, religious freedom for the Buddhists.
Right, for
sure. So he opposed, you know, both the dictators as a student activist and the communists. He did not like what the communists had been doing. He had spoken with many intellectuals who had influenced his thinking, who had been, you know, thrown in jail by the communist system in the north. See, one of the problems with the communists in Ho Chi Minh especially was there were lots of nationalists in Vietnam, and the Communist Party, when it seized power at the end of World War II, started eliminating those nationalists and either assassinating them or throwing them in, imprisoning them. And Nguyen was a Vietnamese nationalist, and he didn't see any reason for why the Communist Party should have a monopoly or a dictatorship over, you know, the people in that country. So Nguyen believed in democracy, and he believed in the, you know, the free market, you know, capitalist system. And that's where his thinking was, and he always thought that the refugees here, you know, had done very well under a free market, you know, capitalist system, as opposed to in Vietnam after the war where the economy collapsed. So I just want to make that clear that Nguyen was anti-dictatorship but also anti-communist.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. We're talking with Jeff Brody, who's the professor at Cal State Fullerton, communications professor, about the life of Yen Do, who was the publisher of Noi Viet. This is Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org on the web. Was he a stringer? Was Yen a stringer for the foreign press also in Vietnam?
Well, what happened is that there are a lot of foreign journalists who were flocking to Vietnam during the war, and they would often hire local journalists, sort of like assist them, and so what were called like leg men.
Mm.
And that's what Yen was. He would perform those kind of functions where they would arrange interviews, do translating, oftentimes even go out and do reporting at the front, and then, you know, send their dispatches back to the foreign reporters. And he, at the end of the war, he worked with a group of them, including Philip Caputo, who later wrote A Rumor of War. Caputo was, at the time, had been working, I think, for the Chicago Tribune.
Were you based in Vietnam then? Or?
No, I was never in Vietnam during the war. I visited Vietnam after the war. I was a little younger.
When did you actually go?
The first trip I made to Vietnam was in 1988.
Oh, wow.
And when the country was opening up.
Yeah, yeah. He never, how come he was never able to go?
This is really sad. This is like one of the saddest aspects of his life, and it
his mother
deeply
was
affected him. His father had passed away, you know, before 1975, but his mother was in Vietnam.
Right.
And because Nguyen was a community leader, he had been under observation from the right-wing government in right-wing anti-communists in the community, and then the communist government in Vietnam, because. So he was considered to be subversive or potentially subversive by the right-wing elements of the community in Orange County and by the government of Vietnam, who often didn't like what Noi Viet was printing.
Yeah, they didn't trust
him. He was,
yeah.
The government of Vietnam did not trust him.
Right,
I said, you know, he was for democracy and independence. So what happened was, if he went to Vietnam, he was afraid he'd be attacked by the right-wing elements in the community as being pro-communist. And if he also went to Vietnam, he's afraid that the communists might arrest him or fine him or, you know, harass him. So he was, like, caught in the middle.
But even after the embargo ended, he couldn't go?
He was always afraid. And then when he finally, you know, it was, you know, he probably could have gone. His health had deteriorated.
Yeah.
So he couldn't go for health reasons.
Yeah, even when... You remember the ceremony at UCI when he got honored for service on this Southeast Asian Archive board? He was very weak then.
Yes. His, he started suffering from complications of diabetes and kidney disease around the year 2000.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was a, sort of like a downhill spiral.
I know that Seth Meidens in the New York Times did a piece on him. A few years back, maybe last year even, but I was surprised I didn't see an obituary in the paper there.
Me too. And I had emailed Seth and I said, "Are you planning on an obituary?" And I haven't received a response from Seth.
Yeah, maybe.
So I can't answer that.
Yeah. Did any coverage? I tried to look on the web, but I didn't see any coverage in the Vietnamese press in Vietnam.
I don't know about that. I'd have to check and get back to you.
I checked
that.
On google.com.vn, I guess.
Well, you know, as I said, he was not a favorite of the regime.
But I...
Because Nguyen Viet, you know, was printing articles about Vietnam.
Right, for sure.
And some of them were critical. You got to remember that although the regime has made reforms, they favor free enterprise over free press. You know, many of the communist nations are now fine with free enterprise, but they're lacking in free press. Vietnam, represses its internet services.
Oh, for sure.
Now, Nguyen Viet circulates in Vietnam, you know, through the internet and through people, you know, like bringing it in clandestinely.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there is, the government would never permit, you know, the Nguyen Viet website to have like open access to people in Vietnam or allow Nguyen Viet to distribute in Vietnam, although Yen would, you know, have liked that to happen.
Although
it only happened, you know, through the underground.
A student just told me he was in Vietnam last month and he was able to actually access the website by some alternative, you know, typing it with a hyphen or something.
Yeah, there's alternative ways that people in Vietnam have developed, but they're officially not allowed to be distributed in Vietnam.
For sure. The
That I can tell you. The government wants to repress it.
Well, they definitely control the resources, sources of information. His family got involved in journalism too. I mean, at least his daughter,
His daughter is following in his footsteps. Anne went to USC Journalism School. She's been a columnist and reporter for the Orange County Register, and she now edits the English language version of Nguyen Viet for the second generation.
She has a piece in today's Register, actually, a remembrance of her father.
Yeah, very moving.
Yes, and do you feel that she has more chance to, you know, I know his father was always playing this kind of navigating between these treacherous waters. Does she have more, because she's a Western-trained journalist, does she have more kind of opportunity to take a more of an advocacy role that is different from her father's? Or what do you think?
Well, I think it's, you know, one generation passes and the next generation, you know, enters the picture. And what we'll see with the Vietnamese community is that the more moderate, you know, more tolerant, more educated people in America, will be ascending to power. So, you know, Anne grew up and, you know, went to, you know, U.S. schools, and the Vietnamese community, their children are growing up, you know, going to U.S. schools and learning about the First Amendment and learning about political tolerance. And so you may see more acceptance of divergent views in the community and expressed in the press as well.
She's also a woman, obviously, and she. But there was something in your book that you mentioned that Yen was saying that at the beginning they didn't really want women in Nui Viet because they had the experience of a employee's wife showing up and caused a lot of trouble. What was that about? Did he explain what that trouble was?
It's probably best not to go into that right now. But basically, Yen, you know, was for women's rights and equality.
For sure.
And,
yeah.
And you know, there are a great deal of females working at the paper right now.
For sure. Yeah.
And Anne is, you know, in a very high position.
Yeah, for sure. So that changed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely changed. Do you feel that she? He was able to work well with the mainstream community. How do you think Yen was with the mainstream
community? Yeah, many journalists, many political leaders would come to him for consultation about, you know, community affairs. He had a tremendous influence over a widespread group of people, not only in Orange County, but in the nation and in the world. Yen was constantly meeting with activists, you know, in Europe, Vietnam, from, you know, Vietnamese communities across the United States. People were always visiting him. I was always amazed, always a whirlwind of activity. This visitor, this artist, this writer, you know, this former politician, this government leader. What a, you know, he had a, this is what eventually wore him down, was it? He was going almost like 24/7. A selfless man.
And he even sent people to Russia, right, to Soviet Union, to find out what was happening to Vietnamese there.
Yeah, one way to report about Vietnam was there are a lot of guest workers in the Soviet Union who are Vietnamese, and so you could send Nui Viet could send, you know, correspondents to the Soviet Union, interview these guest workers, and get a feel for what's going on in the country. And often these guest workers would talk, you know, more freely than if they were living in Vietnam.
How do you think Nui Viet will change now after his death?
Well, that remains to be seen. He hasn't been active in the newspaper because of his health for the past year. So
right.
We haven't seen major changes in the paper, you know, during this year. So it's just something we'll have to watch and monitor.
You know, there's a lot of controversy that stirred up a few months ago when there was an effort that I believe you suggested to name a street after him.
Sure.
And part of the opposition was from other newspapers that are competitors, I guess, huh?
Mm-hmm.
People that had other newspapers, they were on the same street.
As I said, there's a lot of jealousy and backbiting and, you know, infighting among the community.
But do you think that's a good sign that there's a free press?
I welcome a free press.
Right.
I believe in a free press.
Right.
I just felt that he should have been honored.
For sure, yeah.
And I think it's shame on the city council for not doing that.
Is this city...
You know, there's no street named after a Vietnamese person in the city of Westminster.
Oh, that's appalling.
And, you know, he would have been the first. And we had, you know, most of the merchants on the street, including, like, Frank Chow, his little Saigon's leading developer behind it.
Right, right.
And it's just a shame that the city council did not have the, you know, fortitude.
Yeah.
To do something like this.
But you had said that the city council was, didn't they have any more Vietnamese people on it?
Well, there is one Vietnamese person on the city council, Councilman Andy Kwok.
Yep.
Who happened to be in Europe when the vote was taken. I asked him to postpone the vote or withdraw the vote when I realized that, you know, he wasn't going to be approved because I didn't want Yen to lose face, his family to lose face, but they didn't even do that. They, you know, with Kwok, you know, absent, they voted against the street.
Is it an old-time politics thing or is it a racial thing or what do you think it is?
Well, we have to examine it. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Here, Yen is one of the four founders of Little Saigon.
For sure.
He represents media. Zhao is another founder, represents business. Mai Kong in social services. And Tony Lam, the first councilman. And it just seems to me pretty appalling that the city council could not honor the memory of the man who has done so much. You got to remember, Little Saigon was a rundown shopping center. Westminster was, you know, a town on the skids.
Like a bedroom community.
And yeah. No, actually, the whole Bolsa Avenue was a rundown industrial area. I mean,
in the 80s?
It was impoverished. I mean, the shopping centers were going nowhere. And the Vietnamese built a thriving commercial district. It put Westminster on the map. And he was one of the people who did it through media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Time magazine came, you know, to do an article on immigration, they interviewed Yin Do.
Right.
And not to recognize his achievement by, you know, putting the street, you know, the Fleet Street of Vietnam,
right,
Saigon, you know,
for sure.
To me, it's just shocking.
Because one former mayor was saying that he just put out a newspaper, he didn't do anything for the city.
That's ignorant.
Yeah, that seems very narrow-minded.
It's narrow-minded, it's ignorant.
And I think he's the same, was he the same guy that said Vietnamese should go back to Vietnam, I think, at one point, and then he changed his tune. Later.
I had something to do with a parade. That was Frank Fry.
That was Frank Fry. That was a different...
Yeah, when they wanted to have a parade, he told him he was against the parade. Then he flip-flopped on that.
Right. So there's kind of Republican... I guess they're Republicans, I suppose, everybody there. Huh?
I don't know the composition of the council. I cannot answer that.
But he was in your little book also of interviews, you also mentions the start of the... You know, how the Republican Party reached out to the Vietnamese community in Little Saigon. It seems to me the Democrats just... Mike Kong was a Democrat.
Yes, he is a Democrat, yeah.
And she has a picture of, I think, you know, the president, was it Clinton? Shaking shaking her hands, apparently, in her office. But why do you think... I know politically, of course, there's this... The Vietnamese community is traditionally Republican, but I know from the voting statistics that a lot more people in Little Saigon are actually registering independent or moving towards other parties. Do you think it's a generational split?
Oh, that could be. We have to, you know, check out the data more and examine it more thoroughly. I know initially refugees were attracted to the Republican Party because of its perceived, you know, hard line against the communists. Also, the Republican Party is a party of free enterprise, and so many of the refugees are small businessmen.
Yes, definitely. And that's how they survived. How about the, you mentioned how there was all these other controversies with housing assistance and also welfare issues and Medicare. How did he cover this these kind of community issues? Because he saw himself as a community advocate. How did he cover these in the paper?
Well, he was involved. You know, when the Medi-Cal crisis came, he reported it for the community. He would listen to the community point of view, and try and give complete and total coverage. And whenever there was a crisis, I mean, the role of the editor is to, sort of explain it to people in the community of what's going on. And he did a very good job at that.
It's a community paper, basically, yeah.
It is a community paper. I mean, Noi Viet is a community. It means Vietnamese people.
Right.
So he runs it as a community paper. I mean, it does two things very, very well. It provides news of the homeland, news about Vietnam, and news about Vietnamese communities, including this community in Orange County, but other communities across the country. And he has correspondents who will send him information of what's going on in Vietnamese communities across the country and the world, including Paris, as well as, they scour the world press for articles and information about Vietnam, and they write, heavily about Vietnam. So you will buy Noi Viet for those two reasons, that you will get the information about the Vietnamese community locally and about Vietnam. And you'll get it in Vietnamese if you're a Vietnamese reader, and now you can get part of it in English.
Right, right, right. I know you mentioned in your book of interviews that he wanted to set up a community space where people in the community could meet and discuss issues.
He set up a community meeting room, and it was a brilliant idea. I mean, what better way to cover the community than have the meeting room right at your newspaper?
So the issues get debated there, and then he can write about it.
Exactly. And he'd have like artists come and writers groups or political groups. And it works out really well. Every newspaper should do that.
For sure.
And you have this community room that's free to anyone in the community to use, and your staff can just walk over and cover it.
I know when I used to go to the Register, it's, you know, you can't go upstairs, you know. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, there are guards everywhere, it seems.
Yeah. No, I really think it's a great idea.
Yeah,
They have, like, concerts. They have art shows.
Yeah.
They have forums.
Yeah, I've been there when the line was outside the door. It was, like, you know, totally packed.
And this is a great way for the newspaper to connect to its constituency.
Yeah, it's a...
It's wonderful. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I remember going there last year during a incident with over the shooting of Huang Bui, who was shot. A car, a police car ran over him as he was fleeing from his own car after a minor traffic accident, and the community people, actually, dozens of people met there every week or so to talk about the case. And
exactly,
so it was definitely open to the community.
Yeah, the room is open to everyone, anyone in the community who wants to use it.
So that's and there was a huge space, actually, a lot of space. And,
yeah,
and they have had art shows there, like you said.
Sure.
And, yeah.
No, it's a great idea.
Do you know?
See, newspapers are losing readers because they fail to connect to the community.
For sure. Yeah.
This is the way that this newspaper connects to the community.
Do you think
he also would give money to artists? He would hire artists and writers.
Oh, right.
To work at the paper. He was very. I gotta mention, the last thing I can tell you is that Yendo could have been a very wealthy, you know, publisher living in, Corona del Mar. But what he did was he modeled his newspaper after the French newspaper Le Monde,
right,
which is owned by the staff.
Yeah,
and he gave stock ownership and benefits to the people on the staff.
It's like a collective.
Exactly, and he, if people needed money, to get a down payment for a house, he would give them the money or lend them the money. They needed money for a car if they were sick or ill. Neu Viet would give money to the workers. And he'd give stock ownership to the workers. And he saved stock. He gave some of his own stock to new arrivals who had arrived as late as like 1993.
Wow.
Instead of keeping the profits to himself, he shared them with his staff.
These are stocks he invested in. Or is it the company stock? What do you mean?
No, the ownership of the company.
Oh, I see.
He gave shares in the company. It's privately owned.
Oh, privately owned,
but
yeah.
But he gave shares to the people who work there.
Wow.
Instead of, he could have kept the profits for himself.
Yeah.
But he gave them to the people who work there. And he gave them to the community. He supported art functions. The Neu Viet has a social fund. It gave $30,000 to my school,
Cal
State Fullerton,
for
research projects related to the Vietnamese American community. It's a very generous, generous newspaper, and he was a very generous man. He, as Ann mentions in her article today in the Register, he would give him shirts and with monograms with his initials, Don Ngoc Yen.
Yeah.
And she'd find other people wearing those shirts because she'd ask her dad, and he'd say, well, those people needed them more than me.
Wow.
And that's the kind of guy he was.
He didn't get trained as a journalist, but it was on-the-spot training, right? He started writing during the war. Self-taught, yeah.
Vociferous reader.
And he did
photographic memory.
Yeah. I think her daughter mentions that he can read a map and look at a map and just remember everything.
Yeah, photographic memory. Can cite books that he read like 20 years ago, 30 or 40 years ago. Incredible intellect.
So
always reading.
He didn't end up in any camp before he came, I mean.
No, he went to Camp Pendleton.
Organized. Oh, okay. Oh, right there. Yeah, yeah. But he wasn't put in any re-education camp.
Oh, not at all. He fled in 75.
Oh, right.
He was the first wave.
Yeah. So do you see that there's a chance for the paper to, you know, I know in the mainstream press, they've been cutting back, you know, all these papers are cutting bureau, foreign bureaus and all that stuff. Do you feel that it will eventually just go online or not?
Well, they do have an online presence, and they have an English section. What generally happens with the newspapers that are ethnic-oriented is as the second and third generation establishes itself in America and the first generation passes away, the papers shift from their language of the homeland to English.
Mm.
And you see Neuwied has begun to make that adjustment.
And also to cover, I guess, but homeland politics would still be a big thing, right? I mean,
always is.
It always is. It still is for ethnic papers all over.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, there are papers, you know, in the Jewish community that have, like, a very heavy emphasis on the Mideast and Israel, of course. Israel
for sure.
First.
Yeah.
And what's going on in the Mideast, there are papers, you know, in the Latino community that have a heavy emphasis, you know, on Mexico.
Yes.
So the Vietnamese papers will have a heavy emphasis on Vietnam.
Do you see that the price will go up? It's still pretty cheap, right? It's a quarter of, mm-hmm. or something like that. I guess they haven't. How did he survive at the beginning with such low funding? I mean, just, you know, hundreds of dollars or thousands.
It was a one-man operation.
Yeah, at the beginning, yeah.
He was the circulation manager, the advertising manager, the distributor, the writer, the editor, everything.
So when they when the right-wingers burned his delivery truck,
mm-hmm.
He had to move upstairs, I guess. He couldn't, there was some compromise, right? He couldn't be editor, but he could be publisher. How did that work out? I mean, what was that about?
Oh, he served as publisher of the paper, but at that time he was ready to assume those kind of duties anyway.
Oh, anyway, yeah.
I mean, he had his imprint on the paper throughout.
Right, still had it. As publisher, he still had it.
It didn't matter whether he was editor or publisher. He was, Yendo.
Right.
He was.
He was the
founder of the paper. The paper reflected, you know, his vision as well as the vision of the many talented people who work there. And, you know, you got to give him credit as an, you know, immigrant success story that, you know, he saw a void of, you know, a void for news and information in an ethnic community, the Vietnamese, and he filled that void. And no one will ever be able, you know, to, you know, fill his footsteps.
For sure.
The pioneering effort that he made, you know, the effort of, you know, being a journalist and a community activist and, you know, going out and getting the news under, you know, severe pressure from, you know, the political context of the community. You got to give him a lot of credit.
Do you know if, how did you get assigned this beat, I guess, when you were working for the Register? By
accident.
Oh, huh.
I mean, what basically happened was the L.A. Times had done a story on Buena Clinton, which was Orange County's, like, worst slum.
Oh.
And it was a three-part series. And the Register looked at me, and it begun on Sunday, and they said, go to Buena Clinton. And I said, catch up.
So
I went to Buena Clinton and walked around and saw the needles and the junkies and, you know, interviewed some of the cops. And I was with a photographer, and it was getting hot. So around, like, noon, we walked into this liquor store, you know, for a break. So I was getting, like, a Diet Coke, and I look up at the front of the store, and the photographer is, like, Lauren Al, his name, was, you know, clicking pictures a mile a minute. His motor drive was going, you know, into overtime. And he's taking photos of this slender-looking Vietnamese in a, like, brown leather jacket. So I went up to Lauren and I said, like, who's he? What are you doing? He says, don't you know who he is? And I said, no. Lauren goes, like, well, he's Nguyen Cao Ky, the former premier. And I said, like, what's he doing in Buena Clinton? And Lauren said, well, you're the reporter. You go find out. And that led to this odyssey that has continued, you know, like the 80s of finding out about the Vietnamese community.
So it wasn't
an incredible run for me, and one of the first people I met was Yen Do in 1984.
And, oh, sure.
We've been friends and, you know, colleagues, and now I've served almost as his unofficial biographer.
Yeah.
Biographer by writing this book, and I have another installment of the book, which I hope to put both installments together and, you know, publish it in in academic press of his complete, like, oral history of his life.
Oh, wow. Are you going to put the audio up, or is that is that hard to do? Or?
Pardon me?
Are you going to put the audio of clips of some of the...
No, basically what we did is we did tapes, and we did re-editing and re-editing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To do an oral history and to do it well.
For sure.
We met, and we did, like, two drafts of this project.
Oh, wow.
And I continued to work with him, you know, almost until his death.
For sure, yeah.
But we got it completed before his death.
Well, that's
he was very happy that,
yeah,
you know, the complete work has been finished and it's been edited. And now what I have to do is, you know, just put in some, you know, revisions and send the manuscript out to a publisher.
So that's his legacy.
And that will be his legacy, that's right.
Well,
but
that,
more than that, the legacy will be his paper.
For sure.
And the legacy is the influence he's had over his children and Anne, who will, you know, direct the paper.
The funeral, the memorial service is at St. Barbara's Church in Santa Ana.
On Thursday.
Thursday at 10 a.m. You can go to the Subversity website at kuci.org/tilde-dtsang for more information on where the service is. Oh, I guess we're out of time. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Dan.
That was very, very moving. Thank you.
Pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
That was Jeff Brody, who was a former reporter for the OC Register and now a communications professor at Cal State Fullerton, talking about the life and times of Yen Do, who published Nguyen Viet People, Vietnamese People, the newspaper, the largest the Vietnamese language newspaper outside of Vietnam, who passed away last week, last Thursday. This is Dan Sang with Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.